We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine.
Get my feet out. Okay, I'm out.
How does it feel for the United States to be the new record holder?
At last, huh?
They're rolling up as we can't turn anything off. Continually increasing in the left roll. In about 4 to 5 times more work than what we anticipated, and the pilot visor is completely locked over, nearly frozen over.
So in that baby light, there's no doubt about it.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 84 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Gemini 11 with Charles Pete Conrad and Richard Gordon, Part 2. We left off last time with the Gemini 11 and Atlas Agena on their respective launch pads getting prepared for liftoff. It was the morning of September 12, 1966. Conrad and Gordon arrived at the pad and stepped into their seats exactly on time. Gunter Wendt, the McDonnell pad leader, signaled his men to close the hatches, but they soon had to reopen Conrad's hatch. Conrad had suspected that some oxygen was leaking from his side of the cabin, and he was right. When the hatch had been fixed, the countdown went on. At 8.05 a.m., the Atlas roared into action and lifted off into the sky. The craft performed flawlessly, and the Agena was inserted into orbit as planned. Back at Pad 19, the astronauts were anxiously awaiting liftoff. In order to execute a first orbit rendezvous, the launch window for Gemini 11 was unbelievably short. In fact, it was the shortest launch window in the entire Gemini program. Gemini 10, for example, had 35 seconds in which to launch. Gemini 12 would have 30 seconds. But Charles Matthews had informed McDonnell and SSD that Gemini 11's launch window was only long enough for an on-time launch. The post-launch mission report, however, gave 2 seconds as the length of the window for the first orbital rendezvous. Rocketeers of the 40s, 50s, and early 60s would have been aghast at the idea of having to launch within 2 ticks of the clock. Precisely at 9:42, 26 and a half seconds, just a half of a second into the second launch window, the Titan booster lifted Gemini 11 toward a first orbit rendezvous with near-perfect accuracy. At 6 minutes, the flight control radioed, "Gemini 11, you're a go for M equals 1," which meant they were go for a first orbit rendezvous. The message came at booster separation when debris could be seen out the window. Gordon had warned himself not to look, but temptation got the better of him for a brief instant. Gemini 11 was inserted into a 161 by 279 kilometer Earth orbit at 9:48 a.m. Immediately upon insertion, Conrad and Gordon performed an insertion velocity adjustment routine, or IVAR, maneuver, to correct the flight path up, down, right, left, and to add or decrease speed as needed. During IVAR, any decrease in spacecraft speed, such as a retrograde firing, is done with great care because of the danger of re-contact with the launch vehicle. The rules therefore say that pilots must have the booster in sight before they can begin to lower their speed. Their computer showed the crew that they had made very precise insertion corrections that would help them catch the Agena, only 430 kilometers away. The first onboard calculations had succeeded. Now it was time to try again. There would be no help from the ground, as Gemini 11 was out of telemetry and communications range. At the appointed moment, Conrad made an out-of-plane maneuver of 1 meter per second. He then pitched the spacecraft nose 32 degrees up from its horizontal flight plane. Now came the test to see if their first figures had been right. They turned on the rendezvous radar. The electric lock-on signal registered immediately. Happily, the crew switched the onboard computer to the rendezvous mode and began preparing for the final part of the catch-up. When they could talk to the ground again, Gordon said, quote, "Be advised, we are within 50 nautical miles," end quote. John Young, the Houston Capcom, then cut in over the remote line through Tenerife to give the crew some numbers for the remainder of the chase. Conrad and Gordon checked these calculations against their own and found the difference so minor that they could have used either set for the job. They decided to stick with their own solutions. Just as the spacecraft neared the high point of the orbit, Conrad fired the thrusters to produce multi-directional changes, forward, down, and to the right, to travel the remaining 39 kilometers. Suddenly, the Agena, whose blinking lights they had been watching in the darkness, flashed into the sunlight over the Pacific and almost blinded them. They scrambled for sunglasses, then Conrad jockeyed the spacecraft to within 15 meters of the target's docking cone. Over the coast of California, only 85 minutes after launch, rendezvous in the first orbit was achieved. A gleeful crew called out to the flight director, quote, "Mr. Kraft, would you believe M equals 1? End quote. He would. Moreover, they still had 56% of their maneuvering fuel. This transmission made a believer out of Mission Director Snyder. He pulled a $1 bill out of his pants and paid his bet with James M's and said, "I never lost a better dollar." Here's the clip for station keeping.
Okay, we're station keeping.
Roger, outstanding.
After appropriate congratulations, Young told Conrad and Gordon to go ahead and dock. Seconds later, Conrad reported rather matter-of-factly, "We are docked."
"We are docked, Richard Lightstone."
"We confirm they're docked, Frank."
"Roger."
The primary objective of first orbit docking was now complete. The Gemini 11 crew had an opportunity to do something else that NASA had wanted for a long time: docking and undocking practice. Each man pulled out and drove back once in daylight and once in darkness. It was easier, much easier, Conrad said, than in the docking trainer on the ground. For the first time, also, a co-pilot was given the chance to dock with a target vehicle. Even while docking and backing away from the Agena, the crew was meeting another flight objective. Attached to the Agena target docking adapter was the S-26 experiment that studied the ion wake structure during docking practice. Two other experiments were started at that time: S-9, the nuclear emulsions, and a modified form of S-29, librations region photography. The crew turned on the emulsion package shortly after the hookup with the target, and a telemetry check disclosed that it was working. Gordon later retrieved it from behind the command pilot's hatch. S-29, a study of dim light phenomena, could not be carried out as planned because of the 3-day mission delay. The Milky Way now obscured the intended target. Instead, the crew photographed two comets and the Gegenschein, which is the sunlight backscattered by interplanetary dust. After the last docking, the crew used the main Agena engine in a test run before going to high altitude. Facing 90 degrees away from the flight path, Conrad fired the main engine, adding a velocity of 33 meters per second, to pull over into a new orbital lane. This really impressed them. Gordon remarked to Capcom, which was John Young, who had flown the Agena spacecraft combination in Gemini 10, quote, "I agree with you, John. Riding that primary propulsion system is the biggest thrill we've had all day," end quote. Now, after 6 hours of hard but frustration-free work, Conrad and Gordon powered down the spacecraft systems, ate a meal, and soon got a good night's salutation from the network. For 8 hours, they dozed and rested, awakening, as Gordon said, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. The only complaints the pilots had were about their dirty windows. Dirty windows had plagued all Gemini flights. But beginning with Gemini 9A, all spacecraft carried covers that could be jettisoned after the launch phase. But they did not seem to help much. Earlier, Conrad had asked if Gordon could wipe his window when he went outside. Now, Alan Bean, who had taken over from John Young as Capcom, told the pilot to rub half the command pilot's window with a dry cloth and bring the rag back for testing. Conrad and Gordon napped and rested a while longer, then started their next major task, preparation for EVA. 4 hours before they were to open the hatch, the crew began to get their suits ready for the vacuum environment. They had practiced this so many times on the ground, Conrad said, that they soon realized they did not need all that time. Within 50 minutes, the gear was ready and running. Just a few more steps and Gordon would have gone out, so Conrad called a halt, which left them sitting there, as he later said, quote, "with all the junk on," end quote. An hour later, they hooked up Gordon's environmental support system, and he made some oxygen flow tests. This was also a mistake. They quickly perceived the system dumped oxygen into the cabin, which in turn had to vent the excess into space. They could ill afford this rate of oxygen loss, and Conrad had Gordon switch back to the spacecraft system. Gordon, uncomfortably warm, was glad to get back on the interior system. The extravehicular system heat exchanger had been designed to operate in the vacuum of space, not in a pressurized cabin. Briefly, the two men considered asking Flight Director Clifford Charlesworth to let Gordon go out a revolution early, but they decided to keep on schedule. As they sat and waited, they soon regretted that decision. At last, it was almost time to open the hatch. Gordon began putting a sun visor on his faceplate, which was a real chore and one which should have been done before he put on this extra gear. Conrad finally got the left side fastened, but he could not reach across Gordon to fasten the other side. Gordon was now getting hot and bothered and had to rest. Time had been hanging on their hands before. Now it was rushing past. Gordon wrestled with the right snap for 5 minutes and finally got it fastened, cracking the visor in the process. He was thoroughly winded before he got out of his seat. Next, the Gemini cabin atmosphere was evacuated and the hatch opened to begin Richard Gordon's scheduled 107-minute EVA. "Here come the garbage bags," Conrad warned. Everything in the spacecraft that was not tied down began to float toward and out, including Gordon. Outgassing of the environmental system caused this, and the crew expected it. Conrad grabbed for a strap on the leg of Gordon's suit and held him in the seat. After the pressure equalized to a vacuum, Gordon emerged from his seat at 9:51 a.m., attached by an umbilical cord. First, he deployed a handrail, which was easy. Next, he picked up the S9 nuclear emulsions package and handed it to Conrad, who shoved it down between his legs into the footwell. Gordon then tried to install a camera in a bracket to photograph his own movements, but this was more difficult. Finally, Conrad let enough of the umbilical slide through his gloved hand to let the pilot float above the camera and hit it with his fist to drive it into place. Now it was time for the spacewalker to move forward and attach a 30-meter tether housed in the Agena target docking adapter to the spacecraft docking bar. When Gordon pushed himself forward, he missed his goal and drifted in an arcing path above the target's adapter and around in a semicircle until he reached the adapter behind the spacecraft. But Conrad had released only 2 meters of the 9-meter umbilical, so he pulled Gordon back to the hatch to start his trek again. This time Gordon reached the target and grabbed some fixed handrails to pull himself astride the spacecraft nose. "Ride 'em, cowboy!" Conrad shouted. Riding bareback, with his feet and legs wedged between the two docked vehicles, was hard to do. In practice sessions in zero-G aircraft flights, Gordon had been able to push himself forward, straddle the re-entry and recovery section, and wedge his feet and legs between the docking adapter and the spacecraft to hold himself in place, leaving his hands free to attach the tether and clamp it down. But this did not seem to work so well in the actual conditions of space. He had to fight his pressurized suit to keep from floating away, and he had neither saddle nor stirrups to help him. All he could do was hold on with one hand and try to operate the tether clamp with the other. He struggled for 6 minutes, finally securing the line. At least they were ready for the tethered flight experiment that would come later in the mission. To Conrad, it was obvious that Gordon was running out of steam. What had been relatively easy in zero-G airplane flight training had become a monumental task. With his face streaming with sweat and his eyes stinging, Gordon groped blindly about. He tried to unstow a mirror on the docking bar so Conrad could watch him when he went to the back of the spacecraft. Gordon tugged at the attachment, but it would not budge. He abandoned the frozen mirror as not worth the effort. So far, he had not had a chance to wipe Conrad's window either. As the pilot inched his way back to the hatch area, Conrad helped him as much as he could. They then discussed whether Gordon should go to the adapter and get the maneuvering gun stored there. Gordon's right eye was still burning, and Conrad could see just how exhausted his pilot was. At this point, Conrad ordered Gordon to return to the capsule. Gordon obeyed his order and returned to the cabin at about 10:12 a.m. and closed the hatch at 10:17 a.m. Here are several clips from the spacewalk. If you listen carefully, you will hear Gordon's rapid breathing, a sign of his exhaustion during his walk.
Let me have some. You got it. I sure hung on something out there. Got it. Good show. How you doing?
Oh, I'm here.
Huh?
I'm here, I guess.
Sure are. problems. Yeah, why don't you just sit down and take a rest? Huh? How you doing?
Tired, Chief.
All right, just rest. Yeah, you got plenty of time. Only been out 9 minutes.
Conrad soon radioed Capcom Young through the Tanner Reeve remote station that he had brought Gordon back in because, quote, he got so hot and sweaty he couldn't see, end quote. Gordon had no trouble getting into the spacecraft, nor did he have any difficulty closing the hatch. It had been only 33 minutes instead of the planned 107. One experiment, D-16 Power Tool Evaluation, was a casualty on Gemini 11, as it had been on Gemini 8. The Power Tool experiment would have to wait for Apollo. Since Conrad and Gordon were surrounded by so much loose gear, they opened the hatch an hour later and jettisoned all the umbilical extravehicular equipment at 11:19 a.m. Although there was a stand-up EVA period yet to come, spacewalking on this mission was finished, and the feasibility of working outside the spacecraft was not settled by Gemini 11. Cernan had told Collins and Gordon about his problems, and Collins had further emphasized his experience to Gordon. Yet, as the flights progressed, each successive pilot continued to be amazed that the simplest tasks were so much harder than he expected. Richard Gordon is quoted as saying, quote, "Gene Cernan warned me about this, and I took it to heart. I knew it was going to be harder, but I had no idea of the magnitude," end quote. Apparently, the supporting engineers had no idea either, since they still had not provided satisfactory restraints to help the crews. The extreme exhaustion of past EVA pilots had sometimes adversely affected the rest of the mission, but Gordon's did not. Flight planners had learned to schedule periods of lesser activity immediately after heavy workloads. Conrad and Gordon began leisurely repacking equipment and restoring order to the cabin. Communications with the ground had dwindled to a brief transmission about spacecraft systems and a crew medical check. Conrad tested a thruster that had been sluggish and found that it was working better. The crew also ate a meal and photographed the air glow horizon. Half an hour before the sleep and rest period, the Rosenaut Victor tracking ship flight controller sent them the numbers for the next big event, the high ride. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 84 of the Space Rocket History Podcast entitled Gemini 11 with Charles Conrad and Richard Gordon, Part 2. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. I hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, it was a pleasure to bring it to you. Thanks for staying subscribed, folks. It's wonderful to have you here. I also want to give a big shout out to my long-term listeners and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. Well, folks, I was able to work one extra salutation in there this week. Did you catch it? It was a good night salutation from the network before the astronauts began their sleep period. And did you notice another thing? The Agena main engine thrust continues to impress the crews of Gemini. When that baby lights up, it's something else. During Gordon's spacewalk, there is a picture of him straddling the spacecraft, trying to connect the tether. And Conrad made the comment, "Ride 'em, cowboy." I posted the picture on Facebook and the website, spacerockethistory.com. You have got to go look at the picture. It has a special meaning to me. It reminded me of a movie. Have you ever seen Dr. Strangelove? Peter Sellers was in it, and he played at least three parts. Anyway, toward the end of the movie, Slim Pickens is in the bomb bay of a B-52, and he's trying to get a bomb to release. And he accidentally falls on the bomb and releases it, and Slim Pickens rides the bomb down like a bucking bronco. That is what comes to mind when I see that picture. If you don't know who Slim Pickens is, Google him and you'll probably remember him. His movie career was mostly westerns, and he did have a very distinctive voice. All right, can you stand one more movie reference? If you don't want to hear it, just fast forward through this part. Now, when I listened to the audio of that spacewalk, Gordon's rapid breathing reminded me of another movie, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I know most of you have seen this movie. Do you remember the part when astronaut Dave took a pod out to retrieve Frank's dead body? The computer, which was named HAL 9000, refused to let Dave back in the spaceship. It went something like this. HAL, open the pod bay door. And HAL would say, "I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that." Eventually, Dave got back in the spaceship, but he had to wear a space suit inside the ship because HAL controlled the atmosphere. Dave's first task, of course, was to shut down HAL, and HAL would try to persuade Dave not to shut him down. HAL said something like, "What are you doing, Dave? I'm feeling much better now, Dave. I really don't think you need to do this." And Dave refused to talk to HAL, so all you could hear was that heavy space suit breathing, which sounded a little like Richard Gordon breathing on his spacewalk, because it got pretty fast and heavy there. Well, if you didn't know it previously, you know it now. I like movies, especially the sci-fi and history genres. Another thought also occurred to me. It seemed almost impossible to communicate how hard it was to work in space. The astronauts were briefed on it before the mission, but nothing really prepared them for the difficulty of it until they experienced it for themselves. Many things in life are like that. Okay, let me move on before I ramble too much. I hope you were able to hear my interview on the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. If you missed it, it is now a podcast, and I placed a link on the Space Rocket History homepage. Look for it in the right column. It was live and 90 minutes long with listener questions emailed and phoned in. I got kind of nervous leading up to that. You know, public speaking and live audience and anything that comes out of your mouth is recorded forever. But Dr. Livingston made me pretty comfortable, and I survived it. We used a landline telephone instead of my Blue Yeti microphone, so my southern accent really came out loud and clear. Check this out if you hadn't had a chance, and I also want to highly recommend Dr. Livingston's show. He has interesting guests every episode. So if you have the opportunity, check that out. The URL is thespaceshow.com. Once again, the URL is thespaceshow.com. If you'd like more information on episode 84, I've posted some images on the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. Please go check that out. The pictures there will make it easier to understand, especially the Richard Gordon cowboy riding picture. Now I have an exciting announcement. If you have an Android device, there is now an app on the Google Play Store, especially for the Space Rocket History podcast. You can use this little app to download the podcast. I put a link for it on the homepage in the right column in the subscribe box. Or you can search for it in the store and you'll find it that way. So if you have an Android device, download the app and you will never miss an episode of the podcast. This app was created by a wonderful listener to the podcast, Martin, and his friend Toby was able to get it uploaded to the Google Play Store. These fine young men did this out of the goodness of their hearts for free. They just wanted to make a contribution to the podcast, and I appreciate it. Space Rocket History salutes Martin and Toby for their contribution to the podcast. Thank you. I was pleased to receive three donations this week. First, we had a donation from Heinrich P. and Jens S., both from Germany. Then we had a donation from Joe Ross from the UK. Thank you, Heinrich, Jens, and Joe, and welcome to the Mercury Atlas level of donation. If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider donating to the show. We have a tiered donation system. You can donate as little as $5, and you will get your name on the donor page at the Sputnik level. Vostok level is $10, Mercury Redstone is $20, Mercury Atlas is $30, Gemini is $40, and Apollo is $50. The details are on the donor page at spacerockethistory.com. And in case you don't know how to donate, it's very easy. Just look for the orange donate button on the top of the right column of the homepage at spacerockethistory.com. Click on it and you are on your way. At last check, the Facebook page was up to 327 likes. As you may recall, we have a goal of reaching 400 Facebook likes by the end of 2014. We are now 73 likes away. Can it be done? I say yes. If you're new to the podcast, Facebook and Twitter are the tools I use to keep listeners up to date on podcast episodes. I encourage you to like the Facebook page and follow me on Twitter. The links to Facebook and Twitter are on the homepage, spacerockethistory.com. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. I want you to feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on social media like Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, Instagram, your homepage or blog, or anywhere else you want to. And thanks to those who've already done this, like Isaac Alexander and Rocket Noob. They retweet my episodes, and I appreciate that a whole lot. I hope to have episode 85 ready by next Thursday. So long for now.